That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. A call for a Monday general strike by demonstrators in Myanmar protesting the military seizure of power has been met by the ruling junta with a thinly veiled threat to use lethal force, raising the possibility of major clashes. A large crowd appeared again at the city center in Yangon with protesters carrying photos of detained leader Aung San Suu Kyi and demonstrating against the military's takeover of the elected government. The call for a general strike was made Sunday by the Civil Disobedience Movement, a loosely organized group leading resistance to the Army's February 1st takeover. Federal aviation regulators are ordering United Airlines to step up inspections of all Boeing 777s equipped with the type of engine that suffered a catastrophic failure over Denver Saturday. United says it is temporarily moving those aircraft from service. The announcements come a day after United Flight 328 had to make an emergency landing at Denver International Airport after its right wing engine, the engine blew apart just after takeoff. The National Transportation Safety Board said in a separate statement that the two of the engine's fan blades were fractured, although the agency did caution that it was too early to draw conclusions about how the incident occurred. The head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog says that Iran will begin offering its inspectors less access, but will still allow the agency to monitor its atomic program. Rafael Grossi made the comments on arrival to Vienna on late Sunday night. He was careful to say that there still would be the same number of inspectors, but there would be things that we lose. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States now stands at the brink of 500,000 deaths from the coronavirus. A year into the pandemic, America's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, calls the looming milestone horrible and historic. The running total of lives lost, as compiled by Johns Hopkins University, was about 499,000 late Sunday. That is roughly the population of Kansas City, Missouri, just shy of the size of Atlanta. The first known deaths from the virus in the U.S. were in early February of 2020 in California. The death toll reached 400,000 on January 19th of this year. In the waning hours in office for former U.S. President Donald Trump. Senior Chinese diplomat Wang Yi now calling on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to work with Beijing to reopen dialogue between the two countries. This is to restore bilateral relationship damaged under the presidency of former U.S. President Donald Trump, according to the Chinese diplomat. Wang, a Chinese state counselor and foreign minister, said Trump's actions to suppress and contain China inflicted immeasurable harm. He has called on Washington to remove tariffs on Chinese goods and abandon what he said was an irrational suppression of the Chinese sector. He's also urging Washington to respect China's core interests and stop interfering in Beijing's internal affairs and conniving, as he puts it, with separatist forces for Taiwan's independence. An internet shutdown Monday morning has been rumored in Myanmar, with the U.S. Embassy among those warning people to be prepared for a blackout. NetBlocks, which tracks internet disruptions and shutdowns, reported that in Myanmar, real-time network data show connectivity is down just to 13% of its ordinary levels. Indian and Chinese troops have completed a pullout from a lake area of their disputed border in the Western Himalayas. It sets the scene for disengagement and other friction points. That's according to both countries. Thousands of soldiers have been facing off since April on the line of actual control, the LAC or LAC. That's the de facto border, including at the glacial Pangong So Lake. Earlier in the month, military commanders agreed to begin pulling troops out, as well as tanks and artillery, and a first step toward full withdrawal. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting is underway in Niger's presidential runoff election.
The major fact of this Sunday runoff elections remains the death of 7 agents of the Electoral Commission in the region of Tillaberi.
A Nigerian military surveillance plane crash kills 7. The lives of 3 million children are at risk in the Democratic Republic of Congo. South Sudan's government spokesperson criticizes a UN report on worsening violence in South Sudan. And the UN Security Council meets today on the political impasse in Somalia.
They are claiming that he has shown an inclination to be an autocrat. He is using the armed forces to suppress political opponents. He has failed to take the country to election. So what they are proposing is a national council to lead the way for the election to take place.
And coronavirus measures and their impact on indigenous people's rights. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Has begun in Sunday's presidential runoff election in Niger. Ruling party candidate Mohamed Bazoum is seen as the favorite over his opponent and former president Mahaman Usman. Reporter Abdul Razak in the Nigerian capital, Niamey, says voting day was spoiled by the death of 7 people.
The major fact of this Sunday runoff elections remains the death of 7 agents of the Electoral Commission in the region of Tillaberi. The vehicle that was transporting them to their polling stations jumped on a stall in the border area with Burkina Faso. Also, in this same region of Tillaberi, armed men disrupt and or stop the voting operations in certain localities located in the border area with the Republic of Mali. However, these incidents did not strongly affect the smooth running of the vote throughout this country. Most of the polling stations open on time and the voters come out to exercise their civic duty in peace.
Coming into the runoff on Sunday, Mohamed Bazoum was seen as the favorite candidate for most Nigerians over his opponent and the former president, Mahamanda Usman. What did the voters have to say about these two candidates on election day?
Bazoum Mohamed is certainly the favorite of this runoff election because, as you know, he is the candidate of this current regime. But his challenger, Mahaman Usman, has also a lot of supporters as well through the country. As you know, he is a former president of the Republic, and he enjoys the support of the main opposition party of the upcoming president's regime.
Of course, this election will not solve all the many problems facing Niger, including insecurity and poverty. What can you tell us about some of the challenges that are awaiting the next president?
Well, that's true. Niger is nowadays facing many challenges in terms of security issue, demography issue, climate change issue, social and economic development issue, and of course, this new issue of health with the COVID-19. So this is all that the future president must save, as well as the population is waiting for.
That was reporter Abdul Razak speaking with us in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. The Nigerian military has released the name of 7 Air Force personnel who died on Sunday after their surveillance plane crashed while returning to the Nnamdi Azikiwe International Airport in Abuja. Here is Air Vice Marshal Abikunle Daramola, Director of Public Relations and Information of the Nigerian Air Force.
Nigerian Air Force Beechcraft King Air Aircraft, Nigerian Air Force 202, that's the registration number, took off this morning en route Mina and reported some level of engine problems and trying to return back to Abuja. Was unable to make the runway and crashed just short of the runway at the the Nnamdi Azikiwe International Airport. There were seven personnel on board. All of them are Nigerian Air Force personnel who are surveillance crew members and airborne tactical observation systems specialists, operators of the surveillance equipment on the aircraft. All seven of them sadly died as a result of the crash. The aircraft is a surveillance aircraft that is engaged in surveillance missions all over the country. So the Nigerian Air Force has released the names after informing the family members and the next of kin, has released the names of the those who all died, paid the supreme price in service of the nation. As you may be aware, the Chief of the Air Staff, Air Vice Marshal Oladayo Amao, has expressed his condolences to the families of the deceased and has prayed for the repose of the souls of all the departed gallant Air Force personnel.
I know you said the investigation has begun. Is there any indication that was this just an ordinary accident?
That is what the investigation will unravel. The remote and immediate causes of the accident will be determined by the investigative panel that has been ordered by the Chief of the Air Staff, Air Vice Marshal Oladayo Amao. So we cannot preempt whatever they will come up with.
You said that the aircraft was returning from Niger State. Was it playing any role in the search for these missing schoolboys?
Yes, that's what I was saying, that it was en route Mina to join efforts related to the abducted staff and students of the Government Science College, Kagara. So it was supposed to join in the surveillance missions in relation to that effort, to join other aircraft and then, of course, the ground troops, the police, and other agencies that are involved in that effort. So that was the mission that it was taken out to embark on when this sad incident occurred.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
All right, thank you.
That was Air Vice Marshal Abikunle Daramola, Director of Public Relations and Information of the Nigerian Air Force. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The UN Security Council meets today to take up the political impasse in Somalia, which has resulted in the delay of that country's presidential election. This comes as 15 candidates, all vying for the presidency, on Sunday sent a letter to the Security Council asking for the council's intervention for President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo to step down and hand over power to a National Transitional Council. Abdirazak Omar Mohamed is a Somali member of parliament and a former security minister.
What they are asking is that a national council to be formed that is comprised of the federal member states, the two speakers of the parliament, the upper house and the lower house, and they should come together and they should discuss and talk a way to hold an election. They no longer include the president whose term has expired to be part of that. They are claiming that he has shown an inclination to be an autocrat. He is using the armed forces to suppress political opponents. He has failed to take the country to election. He has failed to reconcile, and so on and so forth. So what they are saying, what they are proposing is a national council to lead the way now for the election to take place.
All this is taking place as Jubaland and another regional government have said that former President Farmajo should not be a part of any effort to resolve the political impasse in Somalia. What exactly did Jubaland have to say?
What Jubaland wants is that now, since the president's term has expired, that he should not be leading the conference, the electoral conference that's about to take place. They want him to participate, the president to participate. But since he doesn't have the legitimacy to be a president and his term has expired on the 8th of February. So that is one of the conditions. The second condition that they want is that all the stakeholders, including potential presidential candidates, to be included in those discussions. They also wanted the international community to be present so that what has been agreed would be implemented. So these are the three conditions that they have put forward in order for Jubaland to participate in the electoral discussions.
What does this mean now for President Mohamed? We understand he has been meeting with other people.
Well, it doesn't mean anything. If you ask anyone in Somalia, if you ask the political activists what is the position of the president, they will tell you that he's the former president, his term has expired. If he wants to participate in a conference, he can participate, but he cannot facilitate a conference on the election. So all of them are claiming is that he doesn't have the legitimacy to be a president anymore. His term has expired on the 8th of February. And he has failed to take the country to an election. He has failed to reconcile his political adversaries, and so on and so forth.
Abdi Raza Omar Mohammed is a Somali member of parliament and a former security minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 22nd. A spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says the South Sudan government is busy implementing the revitalized peace agreement and not involved in any fighting. Atain Wekatain says, in addition, South Sudan is under an arms embargo and has no weapons to fight. This comes after the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan released a report last Friday saying that violence in South Sudan today was worse than the violence during the country's civil war.
Yes, I know there are some violence which is still happening, particularly the all-out group who are not part of peace agreement are still attacking our forces in central Equatoria. That might be one of the things that the human rights actually report for. Yes, communal violence has been raging on in the area of Warap state, and that is particularly Tonj and the main state. The communal fighting has been going on, but the government of the Republic of South Sudan is not fighting because we are implementing peace agreement. But those writing reports have not been given us a chance to even implement the agreement. Whenever they see us progressing, they will come with a report that they have never shared with us. They should share the report with us prior to the time of publishing it so that we can correct some of the information or give them the information that they might not have. But they only release the report without sharing it with the government.
That sounds like an excuse, because this report says that the local groups that are involved in the fighting are using newer weapons, which suggests that perhaps there's some involvement by forces of the state.
We don't manufacture weapons, and that's I would say this is a bucket lie. But the external force they are talking about may be true, because first of all, we are facing an army embargo. We don't have new guns, and we don't have ammunition. And even now, as the part of the peace agreement, which is a security arrangement, is now on the verge of graduating the forces that were actually controlled and trained, we have no guns.
This letter by the Jeng Council, or the Council of Chiefs, according to this report, they sent your government a letter saying that President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, they are a symbol of a failed leadership and that they should step down. What do you make of that?
I'm just laughing at that statement, simply because, you know, I know the Council of Elders should have been a civil society organization like any other civil society organization that can advocate for the policy. But they went and overstepped what should have been their mandate, and they are now caught up in a situation that is not theirs at all. And I am not sure whether they have read the revitalized peace agreement or a solution of conflict. If they have read that agreement, they wouldn't have come up to call for President Kiir and Riek Machar to step down, simply because calling for the two men to step down is calling for chaos or calling for the anarchy in the country instead of waiting for the provisions of the agreement to be implemented until when the election comes.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bati.
Atain Wekatain is a spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says the lives of 3 million children in the Democratic Republic of Congo are at risk, with many of them living in displacement camps without access to basic social amenities. Mavis Ochere in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
A succession of brutal attacks by fighters using machetes and heavy weapons have forced whole communities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to flee with only the bearers of possessions. Entire families, including children, have been hiked to death. Health centers and schools have been ransacked and villages set ablaze. Alista Tinkert, the UNICEF communications officer based in Goma, says many of the children living in displacement camps or staying with host communities are suffering immensely. He says numerous armed groups operate in the region. Almost every week, there are reports of new attacks by the various militant groups operating in the region. He says UNICEF and other aid agencies fear that unless something is done quickly to help, the situation for children will worsen.
I think first and foremost, the activities of the armed groups in the area needs to be stopped, because although the Congolese army has also been accused of rights abuses, it is, I think, primarily the various armed groups that operate in the region that are responsible for a lot of the displacements and a lot of the children suffering.
Tinkert says children in the region have been denied proper livelihoods as they do not have access to educational and health services, and they lack clean water and sanitation services.
Some of these children have witnessed the most hideous acts of violence, machete attacks and other things. We came across one instance, I mean, it's not difficult to find, I have to say, but we came across several instances of children who were orphaned because their parents had been killed in machete attacks. One child who had been left but dead in the jungle, another child who'd been who'd had his leg amputated in a machete attack. It's absolutely horrific what's happening there, and that's why UNICEF is so worried.
He says an estimated 5 million people in Ituri, North Kivu, South Kivu, and Tanganyika in the eastern DRC are displaced. He says these areas were food insecure after years of displacement, and given the current situation, there is no chance of the problem ending soon. The huge region means it can be hard for aid agencies to reach displaced people, especially when security is poor. And when agencies get to the villages, they find great damage. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
A new study released last week showed the impact on indigenous peoples in the world's five most tropically forested countries as governments move to roll back social and environmental safeguards under the cover of the COVID-19 pandemic. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the pandemic was used to roll back concessions on logging. Lansana Kone, a lawyer with Forest Peoples Program, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the study's findings.
There was no sanitary impact per se. In terms of rollback as well, there was not so much many rollback to observe because we did not experience in recent years strong positive development in terms of regulations. But what we found out was that the government has used the pandemic as an excuse to stop implementing the best practices and also ignore some of the current safeguards, including in terms of granting logging concession to private companies.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the concessions that have been granted to logging companies, how that might have changed in 2020?
Yeah, so there is a moratorium on logging concession since 2002, which prohibits the granting of logging concession. And in January, that was before the pandemic, the government allocated 9 forest concessions to Chinese companies. In June last year, they also granted 4 other contract to a Congolese companies. So this amount to like 12 illegal contract which contravene the moratorium.
The Congo Basin is one of the biggest remaining rainforests in the world. Is that correct? And how is this impacting that? The Congo Basin.
The objective of the moratorium is to prevent and stop deforestation. This kind of contract, which are allocated to private company, can encourage deforestation in the Congo Basin in the medium or short term. So we thought that is a serious rollback in terms of safeguarding the Congo Basin tropical forest and also promoting the best practices and good governance in the forest sector.
Have the logging activities already physically started, or is there still time to have action taken?
I'm not sure about the logging activity yet, but from what I've seen from the civil society organization movement is that they have trying to challenge the legality of this contract before an administrative court. And Greenpeace Africa has released a report recently that I can share with you. So maybe it's possible to see the extent of the activities on ground. But from the moment, the civil society are challenging the legality of this contract.
That was Lansana Kone, a lawyer with the Forest People's Program. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the 2020-2021 Total CAF Confederations Cup group stage draws, which will be conducted today in Cairo, Egypt. The draws will be supervised by CAF's head of competitions, Khalid Nassar. The aggregate winners from the last leg of preliminaries will qualify for the group stages. Apart from the title holders, RS Berkane of Morocco, who have already qualified for the group stage, there are 15 places to fill to complete the team quota for the four groups of four teams each. And staying with CAF, the final group matches in the ongoing Total Under 20 African Cup of Nations holding in Mauritania will be played today when Ghana Under 20 meet Gambia, while Burkina Faso will face Uganda to determine who among the teams will join Central African Republic, Tunisia, Burkina Faso, Uganda and Cameroon, who have already booked their places in the quarterfinals. From football to basketball, where the 20-team FIBA AfroBasket 2021 qualifiers came to a close with only four nations undefeated. With the last window of the qualifiers taking place across two African cities of Monastery in Tunisia and Yaoundé in Cameroon over the last 5 days, 42 games were played as teams battled it out for a chance to compete at this year's African Championship, which will be staged in Kigali, Rwanda from August the 24th to September the 5th. Four teams, including reigning African champions Tunisia, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria and Egypt, outplayed their opponents, winning all their six games. For Kenyan men's basketball team, the Morans, they made history on Saturday night after stunning heavyweight Angola 74-73 in a nail-biting contest in Yaoundé, Cameroon, to qualify for the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 tournament in Rwanda for the first time in 28 years. Coach Liz Mills of Kenya and Morans center Tom Wamkuta both said winning against Angola, regarded as one of the powerhouses of African basketball, was extra special.
We're so excited because we respect Angola so much. This is an African powerhouse. We came in knowing their pedigree, and I think that's why this means so much to us. Obviously, punching a ticket to Rwanda also is great, and we're very happy to be there.
For us, as Kenyans, as the Kenyan players, it's been 28 years since we've been in the last AfroBasket. And for us to do it, to beat Angola, which is a powerhouse in Africa, man. A very great team, great players for many, many years. It's a great honor for us to be able to do that.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, February 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.